Let's turn to the first chapter of the book of Genesis. And in a couple of weeks when we finish the book of Genesis, it will seem like a long time since we started it. And very much is going to go by between the beginning and the end of Genesis. Over 2,000 years is covered in the book. But most people, when they think of Genesis, probably think of Genesis chapter 1. Because, in fact, the word Genesis has almost become a synonym in modern culture for creation. When journalists write about the conflict between creation and evolution, they generally describe it as a conflict between Genesis and evolution. And I think most people are not aware of much else that's in Genesis, except for the story of creation. And we encounter that right at the beginning. In fact, it begins in the beginning. And what I'd like to do is read the entire chapter 1, just so that we can get the whole panorama of the first 6 days of creation, and then go back and comment on what I regard to be pertinent points. I might just say at the outset that I can only give a very small fraction of what I'd like to say about each point, because you have the whole chapter is just pregnant with spiritual truth as well as physical description of the creation. And I have I have 3 hours of teaching in the tape library on the spiritual implications of Genesis chapter 1. And that's after all the physical stuff is considered. In this session, all I really intend to cover is a clarification of what really took place each day and so forth. And that's all that we'll probably have time for in this session. But even then, I'll have to leave out a great deal. But after that, there's another whole way to look at Genesis chapter 1, to draw from it the spiritual meanings that God depicted through the way that he made things. Well, let me just read chapter 1 for starters. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was without form and void. And darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. So the evening and the morning were the first day. Then God said, "Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters." Thus God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven. So the evening and the morning were the second day. Then God said, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let the earth bring forth grass, the herb that yields seed, and the fruit tree that yields fruit according to its kind, whose seed is in itself on the earth." And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, the herb that yields seed according to its kind, and the tree that yields fruit, whose seed is in itself according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. So the evening and the morning were the third day. Then God said, "Let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons, for days and years. And let them be for lights in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth." And it was so. Then God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also. God set them in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth and to rule over the day and over the night and to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. So the evening and the morning were the fourth day. Then God said, "Let the waters abound with an abundance of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the face of the firmament of the heavens." So God created the great sea creatures and every living thing that moves, with which the waters abounded according to their kind, and every winged bird according to its kind, and God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, Be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters in the seas and let the birds multiply on the earth. So the evening and morning were the fifth day. Then God said, Let the earth bring forth the living creature according to its kind, cattle and creeping thing, and beasts of the earth, each according to its kind. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female he created them. Then God blessed them, and God said to them, Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And God said, See, I have given you every herb that yields seed, which is on the face of all the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields seed. To you it shall be for food. Also to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, in which there is life, I have given every green herb for food. And it was so. Then God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. So the evening and the morning were the sixth day. And thus we have the better part of the first week. And just to summarize, since it was quite detailed, and in some cases the wording was deliberately repetitious to maintain sort of a poetic symmetry to the way the events of each day are described, I'll just summarize very quickly. On the first day, God created the heavens and the earth and light. Now, some might say, wait a minute, it doesn't say that he created light the same day as he created the heavens and the earth. And there are some that think that it may not have been the same day. I will nonetheless seek to demonstrate it was the same day that God created the heavens and the earth. He also created light. The second day, God created the atmosphere. That is how we're to understand the firmament. I'll have more to say about that in a moment, but just to make it brief, the firmament was the atmosphere around the earth. As far as we know, the earth is the only planet in the universe that has an atmosphere, a belt of air around it that can sustain life. And so God wanted to make the planet to sustain life, so instead of just having a rock out in space, he blanketed it with a zone of air. And waters, of course, were on the ground, but there were waters above it, too, in one form or another. We'll discuss different possibilities of that in a moment. But the atmosphere and the division of waters below and above the atmosphere are found to be the activity of the second day. Then the third day, there are two significant things God did. Until this time, the whole earth was just covered with water. But now God caused dry land to appear through some kind of seismic activity or, a volcanic activity. The continents began to emerge and to show up. And also God created land plants. Now, we don't know that there were any plants in the sea back when there was only a sea. But all vegetation, probably in land and sea, were created also the same day as the dry land, according to verses 9 through 13. Then in verses 14 through 19, we have the fourth day. And in that day, the sun, the moon, and the stars are described as coming into existence. Again, there are different interpretations of this day. We'll come to them in a moment. Then on the fifth day, God created the creatures that dwell in the sea and those that fly in the air. And on the sixth day, there were two separate and important acts of creation recorded here. The creation of animals on land and the creation of man and woman. It's interesting that the creation of man and woman, though it occurs on the same day as the creation of other land animals, is treated as an entirely separate event. God does not treat the creation of each species separately. Simply all the cattle and all the creeping things and all the land animals appear with a word. But then separately, a decision is made to create man and woman. It is the case that man and woman are not a product of nature, and they don't technically really belong to the animal kingdom. Of course, when taxonomists talk about the classification of living forms, human beings obviously resemble animals more than they resemble plants, for example, and therefore it's natural to talk about us as part of the animal kingdom. But actually, the Bible indicates that man and woman were created separately from the animal kingdom. The animal kingdom was created in broad categories: creatures in the sea, creatures in the air, creatures on land. And after that was all done, then God made something in his own image separately. And thus providing in the creation of man and woman the crowning act of the creation week. Now, I say a week, although we've only considered 6 days. There is a seventh day that makes up the end of the week, but it's not recorded until chapter 2, and we won't talk about that in this session. We won't have time. We will probably in the next one. Now, here's the panorama. Light, first day. The atmosphere, the second day. Land and plants, the third day. The heavenly bodies on the fourth day. Animals in the sea and in the air on the fifth day, and then animals and man on land on the sixth day, and that is the whole of the creation. Now, there have been many theories as to whether this account can somehow be harmonized with modern scientific opinion about how things came into existence. It's obvious that it differs in many respects from the classic evolutionary account of how things came into existence. For one thing, it seems to differ in terms of the time allotted. Here we have things appearing suddenly in successive days. And they're not just, it's not just as if millions of years went by and then there was a day, and then millions of years went by, then there was another day of creative activity. It's the first day, the second day, the third day. Evening and morning separate them from one another. It seems to be a sequence of days such as we normally experience days, separated by a night in each case, and they follow each other immediately, one upon another. This certainly would not agree with general evolutionary theory that is fairly dominant in our culture now in the scientific explanation of things. Science today, at least many in science, seek to convince us that the Earth is billions of years old, and that the creation of life, or the origin of life, started billions of years ago and required hundreds of millions of years to develop. So that you would not find from beginning to end the planet created in the last living form arriving within a space of 6 days total. Here is the first real obvious conflict between the evolutionary story of origins and the biblical story. Now, to try to resolve this conflict. By the way, I should say that when Darwin's theory became popular, it was at first resisted by a large number of religious people who were still loyal to Genesis. After a while, however, as more and more scientists jumped on the bandwagon of Darwinism, it became the orthodoxy of the Western culture that science has proved evolution. Of course, no such thing ever occurred. All you really got was enough people voting to agree with evolution. That's not the same thing as proving it. But when enough scientists began to say, yes, I embrace that doctrine of origins, then, of course, the biblical doctrine appeared to be hopelessly out of sync with what scientific knowledge of modern times had revealed. And that was a bit of an embarrassment for many Christians because, science, after all, is a means by which reality is discovered. And reality is truth, and therefore, if evolution is science, and if science is truth, then evolution must be true. Then how can the Bible be true when there seem to be obvious differences between the evolutionary story and the biblical story? Somewhat to alleviate the embarrassment of believing in the Bible in an age where science rejected it, many Christians came up with accommodationist theories of the interpretation of Genesis. They argued that Genesis is still true. It is true, and it is the inspired word of God. But it is true in a different sense than was once thought. One of the popular ways that Genesis 1 was accommodated with the evolutionary theory, or sought to be accommodated, was by making the days of Genesis not 24 hours in length, but simply symbolic for eras or aeons, possibly days of millions of years each. It was pointed out that it says in 2 Peter chapter 3, that a day to the Lord is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is a day. In other words, God might use the word day to refer to a very long time, not meaning what we mean by that term. As a matter of fact, you can find cases in the Bible where an extended period of time is referred to as a day. The day of salvation. Our great-grandparents might say, in my day, we did things this way. And they use the word day, but they don't mean a 24-hour period. They're talking about their era, their time. And some would say that's all we're supposed to make of the word day in this case. In Genesis chapter 1, each day simply represents an aeon of time, a long age, possibly as much as millions or hundreds of millions of years long. So that you have the seas without life in them for millions of years. And then eventually volcanic activity and other geological activity causes land masses to appear. And within that same aeon, vegetation evolves and appears. And you've got life in the seas evolving on the fifth aeon and so forth. And by extending the length of a day to be almost of indefinite length, then they thought this could help harmonize Genesis with the modern theories of evolution, which argue that millions of years were required to come up with all these life forms. And that way, creationists could say, well, you know, Genesis doesn't tell us how God created. It only tells us that He created. Genesis 1 is not, they said, here to tell us exactly what happened, but just to remind us that it was God that made it happen. That evolution may in fact have been the way that it happened, and it may have been over millions and millions of years, as the scientists are saying. Genesis does not deny this, they said, because the word day is used poetically or symbolically, non-literally. And therefore, it is possible that we have here a description of the events that evolution has only been able to give us more detail about. And God was behind it. Such people we call theistic evolutionists. Many of Darwin's supporters were not at all theistic. They didn't believe in God. They were atheistic or agnostic. But there were always those who still wanted to believe that God had something to do with it and even wanted to hold on to their faith in the Bible. So they sought to find God working through creation. And this is a belief called theistic, which means God is in it, evolution. Now, this was simply a way of accommodating Darwinian theory, which was largely believed to be universally proven and beyond question. Of course, we live in much more enlightened times, and even the scientists who are not creationists are admitting, well, Darwinism is not by any means proven, never was, and probably never will be. In fact, more and more scientists are beginning to say the opposite is true. Science is basically proving Darwinism wrong. That doesn't mean these people are in mass abandoning it and jumping into creation, because many people are Darwinists for philosophical reasons or even for religious or moral reasons. They'd prefer not to believe in God. And therefore, they're not going to jump right into creationism when they find faults with Darwinism. They're looking for other explanations that don't require a God. But, as I say, we do live in more enlightened times in some respects, and scientists now know that Darwinism has not in any sense been proven. But 100 years ago, it was generally thought that it had been. And therefore, if evolution was true and the Bible was true, somehow you had to accommodate the two with each other. And this, what we would call the day-age theory, was brought up to suggest this. However, this doesn't really solve the conflicts between creation and evolution. Even if you would make each day of Genesis millions, hundreds of millions years long, you still don't get the same story as you get from the evolutionary story. For one thing, the order of appearance of items in this list do not agree with the evolutionary idea. You have first all the plants appearing at one time before there are any animals. Evolution certainly wouldn't agree with that. Evolution would teach that from a common living source, plants and animals took their own course of evolution. And that as long as plants were evolving, animals were evolving too. That there were primitive plant life forms along with primitive animal life forms right from the earliest stages of life's history, and that these were developed into separate kingdoms and with their all different branches on their family tree and so forth, so that we now have a tremendous amount of variety of both. But that plants did not all appear here at once, and then animals later. Furthermore, according to this account, all sea creatures, all creatures that live in the sea, were created before all the land creatures were. Likewise, all the flying creatures were created before any of the land creatures were. If this is true, then evolution would certainly be mistaken, because evolutionists believe that birds evolved from land animals, from reptiles that lived on the land. According to this story, the birds were around before there were any land animals for them to evolve from. Furthermore, evolutionists believe that mammals that live in the sea, which would include, of course, the whales and dolphins and such, that those actually also evolved from land mammals, that there were mammals on land, a great variety of them, and some of them went back to the sea and developed body shapes and capacities of reproduction underwater and so forth. And there's not an evolutionist alive who believes anything other than this. They believe that the whales and the dolphins descended from creatures that were once mammals living on land. That's orthodoxy in evolution. But according to this account, all the sea creatures and all the flying creatures were here before any land animals were. It just doesn't work out with evolution. You can make the days as long as you want to. You still have a conflicting story. Furthermore, you have other things very hard to explain. You've got, for example, plant life on the earth before the sun is created. That certainly would not agree with evolutionists, no matter what length you made each of the days. Furthermore, there's very serious reason to doubt that the author wants us to see these days as longer than modern days. In other words, the author seems to bend over backward to define his terms when he uses day and night. Specifically, it says that God separated the light from the darkness. In verse 5, it says he called the light day, and the darkness he called night. Certainly, the impression is that the word day is being used in its normal sense here. It refers to the period of daylight followed by a night, a period of darkness. This succession of light and darkness, as we know now, is caused by the turning of the earth. The sun is more or less stationary in terms of its relationship to the earth, but the earth spins on its axis and takes it's spinning at the surface speed at the equator of 1,000 miles an hour. It's 24,000 miles around, so it takes 24 hours to get all the way around once. Therefore, for about 12 hours, one side of the earth has sunshine on it and the other side doesn't, and then the other part gets it later on. But this succession of light and dark, day and night is... The length of time required is based on the length of time it takes the earth to make one full rotation on its axis. And therefore, the passage of a day, especially there's specific reference to evening and morning. There was evening and there's morning. Now we have that day is over and a new day started. Certainly the language is such as to give the impression, even going further than would be necessary to do so, that we're talking about literal days here. And if the author wished to convey the notion that we're talking about 24-hour days, then there's hardly any way he could have made it clearer than what he has said. If we reject as an a priori assumption that, you know, the earth was not made in six 24-hour days because science tells us otherwise, if that's what we assume, then of course we'll have to find some way to rule out this being 24-hour days. But if the author wished to convey the notion of 24-hour ordinary days, he could hardly have said more than he did to convey that notion. Therefore, I would rule out the likelihood of each day representing an era. Another problem with the day-age association theory is that it's not clear whether anything ever died before Adam sinned. Now, I'm not as dogmatic about this as some evangelicals would be. Some evangelicals say that nothing could have died before Adam sinned, because we're told in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and also Romans chapter 5 that death entered the world through sin, and sin came through Adam. So that Adam's sin brought death into the world. And it is argued that that means, of course, that even animals didn't die before Adam sinned. And plants didn't die. Death did not exist until the fall, they say. Now, Adam wasn't even created till the sixth day. And if each day is hundreds of millions of years long, then that means that plants were running amok on the planet for many hundreds of millions of years, none of them dying, just reproducing and the Earth would soon run out of room for them all if old plants didn't die. I mean, even now, if forest fires didn't take out masses of trees, the forest would just be too cluttered. And actually, forest fires in the natural, started by lightning and so forth, are a necessary part of maintaining the balance of the ecostructure. You have to have the destruction of plants as well as the reproduction of plants to have the ecosystem work properly. If there were hundreds or thousands of millions of years with plants growing, but none died, likewise, you've got hundreds of millions of years of animal life in the sea and in the air and on the land before man sins, then these creatures will be reproducing and reproducing, but never dying. It's going to be very difficult to understand how this could be millions of years of living things on the earth without death. Now, I want to just say, I don't follow every evangelical on this. I'm not sure that Paul is saying that nothing died before Adam sinned. He's specifically talking about the death of human beings and death becoming the universal heritage of human beings. And because of sin in our lives, we die. The wages of sin is death. It is conceivable that had man not sinned, though man would never have died, it's possible that animals and plants still would have experienced death. After all, man was eating plants. And while it's possible to pick fruit off a fruit tree and eat it without killing the tree, yet the fruit itself is made up of living cells, and those have to die, you know, when you consume them. I mean, I think it may be pushing too far to argue that nothing was intended ever to die, even cells, even spinach, you know, even bacteria, you know, they weren't supposed to die, and death only entered when man sinned. It may be a fact that nothing did die before man sinned, but I'm not sure that that's what Paul is affirming. I think what Paul is affirming is that the reason the whole human race is subject to death is because in Adam we all sinned, and death is a consequence of that. And Paul may not in any sense be intending to extend his teaching to include the death of bacteria or plant cells or things like that, or skin cells for that matter, or hair cells. Obviously, things died. They were made to die. God intended that digestion of plants requires the death of those plant cells. Death in itself is not in always a bad thing. But death in human life is considered to be a judgment for sin, and it's not considered to be a desirable thing, and it was not intended. But the main thing I would suggest is that while perhaps if it could be shown beyond the shadow of a doubt that the earth is billions of years old, and that it did take billions of years for all these life forms to appear, that has by no means been proven at this point. If that were proven, then I would be open to the suggestion that each day might be symbolic of a lengthy period of time, but it still wouldn't coincide with evolution. I could conceivably believe that God took billions or millions of years to create everything, though I don't have any reason to believe it. That's the point. All the reasons that Christians began to change Genesis to accommodate science, scientists are not agreeable about anymore. And the evidence they rested on, now that it is known, is shown to be very weak. And therefore, there's not any reason to change the Bible to accommodate science. Let scientists change their theories to accommodate the Bible. The Bible is that which remains unchanged and never been disproven. It's the scientific theories that change with various passage of centuries and generations. So I will just say that at this point in time, I affirm a six-day creation, 24-hour days. I can think of no reason to reject it. There's nothing that would prevent God from doing it at that speed. It would certainly require a tremendous amount of intelligence and power on God's part, but the biblical God has such available. He's omnipotent and he's omniscient, and therefore for him to do it in an instant is no more difficult than for him to do it over millions of years. Frankly, man couldn't do it. If you gave man 100 million years, he couldn't do it. I mean, God, to create in any way, shape, or form requires powers that we cannot fathom and we cannot understand. And for God to be able to do it in an instant rather than over an extended period of time is really no greater or lesser challenge to him. I also want to point out that it indicates that these things came into existence because God said it. And every day, verse 3, verse 6, verse 9, verse 14, verse 20, and verse 24, all begin the telling of a new day's activities. And it says, then God said. In every case, it says, then God said. And what he said was, let there be something or another. And this resulted in their appearance. That certainly disagrees with evolutionary theory. Things did not, under evolutionary theory, spring into existence because God said they should or demanded it. They came necessarily into existence following laws of nature that would have produced them whether God existed or not. So we either have to accept the evolutionary story or the Genesis story. If we accept the evolutionary story, then I think we are compelled to reject Genesis. If we accept the Genesis story, I think we're somewhat compelled to reject evolution. Once again, even the events are not in the right order for evolution. And since there are very good reasons still, after 6,000 years, to accept the story of Genesis, and there are a diminishing number of reasons to accept the evolutionary story, and they are diminishing rapidly, I think that we have nothing to be embarrassed about and say, well, I personally have no problem with this being 24-hour days. If science could prove beyond the shadow of a doubt otherwise, I can adjust my thinking. I could call this a creation poem written in symbolic terms. I could do that, but I have no reason to do so at this point. It still seems to be the best explanation of the way things are. Of course, this raises questions about what is meant by in the beginning. The beginning of what? It wasn't God's beginning. God was already there and had always been there before. This is obviously the beginning of the earth. Is it also the beginning of the universe? It is thought that the universe is at least 30 billion years old. But it looks like this is not only the beginning of the world as we know it, but it's the beginning of the universe, because we have the creation of the sun, moon, and stars within the framework of this week. One thing interesting is that God made the earth and many things in the earth before he made anything in space. That certainly disagrees entirely with the evolutionary notion. I discovered that disparity between the two stories back when I was in second grade. And I didn't even know there was anyone who didn't believe in Genesis. And I was raised in a Christian family. I believed in Genesis right from the beginning. I didn't know that there was such a thing as a theory of evolution. In second grade, at age 7, I had never been told about it. But I was in a secular school, and they showed us a film strip about the origin of the solar system. And they showed that originally the sun was there, a big explosive ball of flaming gases, and there were explosions on the surface of the sun, and these explosions would sometimes propel portions of the mass of the sun out into space, certain distance. In many cases, the gravitational pull of the sun would pull them back, but just occasionally a really big explosion would propel some of these gases far enough out into space that the gravitation of the sun wouldn't pull it back. They'd just keep it in orbit around the sun. And because of the distance from the sun, these gases cooled down and became solids and became the planets of our solar system. The Earth is one of those. And originally it was just a molten mass, but because of it cooling down, moisture that was somehow inherent in the universe condensed on it and formed the seas, and eventually volcanic activity and so forth formed the Earth and blah, blah, blah. Well, I was naive. I didn't know anyone would ever seek to disprove the Bible about anything. I saw this film strip. I thought, well, that's very fascinating, but something didn't set right with me. And during recess, I walked around the baseball diamond, around the perimeter of the schoolyard for the whole recess, thinking, what's wrong with this picture, you know? And I went back, and I thought I figured it out. I went back to my teacher. I said, you know, I think that film strip was wrong, because the Bible says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And later, after that, he made the sun and the moon and the stars. So it doesn't seem like the earth could have come from the sun. And I was truly naive. I mean, I just thought, well, this must have been an oversight on the part. They must have forgotten what the Bible said. And I said, I think they forgot what the Bible says about this. And my teacher, who I don't know whether she was a Christian or not, but she seemed rather embarrassed, as I recall. And she just said, I guess they must have forgotten that, or something like that. But I mean, it's any child can see it. Listen to the evolutionary story and listen to the Bible story. It's not consistent. You can't have them both. Either the earth was made first and everything else was made with reference to it, or else the earth is simply one of zillions of planets that came into existence because of an ever-expanding universe that started from a cosmic egg that went boom and thrust its mass all over the place, and these masses became stars, and these stars produced planets and so forth, so that we now have innumerable stars, each of which have produced by natural process their own solar systems and planets. It doesn't work. You can't match that up with Genesis. Either Genesis is wrong, or this current scientific orthodoxy is wrong. Okay, so I accept basically what Genesis says as the alternative to what scientists theorize. After all, they were not there. God was. To have an eyewitness account from someone who was a living witness to what happened would be much more valuable than the theorizing of people living thousands of years later trying to guess or trying to deduce what happened. So I believe that in the beginning is the beginning of the universe and of the earth. When was this? When was this? This is one area where evolutionists and creationists are often perceived as being at loggerheads, because creationists generally understood the creation occurred several thousand years ago, and evolutionists believe it was 4.5 billion years ago that the earth came into existence, and about a billion years later life began to evolve on it, not 3.5 billion years ago. Certainly the earth can't be both billions of years old and only a few thousand years old. One of those theories is way wrong, and it is thought that science has proven that the universe is billions of years old. Well, it has not been proven. There are some evidences, there are some tests that yield that kind of a figure, but there are other equally valid tests and considerations that yield a much younger age for the earth. Today, among creationists, there are young earth creationists and old earth creationists. The young earth creationists believe the earth is between 6 and 10, maybe 20,000 years old max. And the old earth creationists basically go along with the secular geologists on this and say the earth is 4.5 billion years old, and that God created somewhere in that time. Well, frankly, both views are consistent enough with Christianity to be acceptable in terms of the gospel. Certainly the gospel does not tell us when the earth was created, nor does the gospel message hinge on what one believes about when the earth was created. If somebody believes God created 4.5 billion years ago, they may be right or they may be wrong, but it won't affect their salvation. Likewise, whether they're young earth creationists or whatever. The main issue is, of course, that God created, regardless of when. But I do believe that we surrender too much to the evolutionists when we go to an old earth creationism. As long as there is an old earth, as long as the earth really is billions of years old, it gives the evolutionists an opportunity to suggest, well, that's long enough for evolution to occur. If the earth is only a few thousand years old, there's no way evolution occurred. It just couldn't happen in that period of time, especially since human society is known to have been around for almost the same length of time. If, in fact, humans appeared in the same week that the earth appeared, as the Bible suggests, then there was no time for humans to evolve from amoebas in 6 days. And for that reason, of course, the evolutionist has a tremendous axe to grind about the age of the earth. They need an earth that is billions of years old. Creationists don't have and shouldn't have an axe to grind about it. If it's 4 billion years old, wonderful. We believe creation occurred then. That was the beginning. If it's a few thousand years old, as the Bible seems to indicate, then wonderful again. That's when God did it. The age of the earth, the time of creation, is not a crucial, pivotal issue for the creationists, but it is for the evolutionists. That's why they make a big deal about it. And because they do, they ridicule on a regular basis young earth creationists. And so to avoid ridicule, a lot of young earth creationists have become old earth creationists. They feel like, well, no one can prove that God didn't do it, although they have, it is thought, proven that the earth is very old. So we'll go along with them on the age. We don't surrender anything essential by that. We'll go ahead and say the earth is 4.5 billion years old, but we're still going to hold on to our view that God did it. Well, is it that old? When was the beginning? When did God create the heavens and the earth? What are the evidences? Well, there's, as I say, a variety of them, and I don't intend to give you a complete catalog of evidences at this point, but let me suggest this. There are two principal reasons for saying the earth is very, very old, billions of years old. That is two principal lines of evidence. One of these lines of evidence is the fact that starlight reaches the earth from stars that are believed to be as much as 5 billion light years away. Now, if a star is shining and it is 5 billion light years away, a light year is how far light travels in a year. If it's 5 billion light years, then it took 5 billion years for the light to travel that far. Now, if we can see the light of these stars here on Earth, that means that the light has traveled 5 billion light years to get here. And since light travels at 1 light year per year, and it's had to travel 5 billion light years, then it must have taken 5 billion years for the light to get here from there. Now, it seems obvious that if the light took 5 billion years to get here, it must have existed 5 billion years ago. The stars must have been shining at least that long, it is argued, for their light to have reached this far so that we can see it. And who knows how many stars there are we can't see because their light hasn't gotten here yet, you know. But the very fact that we can observe stars that are 5 billion light years away suggests that their light has been shining at least 5 billion years so that it could traverse the space between us and them, us and it. Now, that is one argument for at least an old universe. That, of course, does not prove anything about the age of the Earth itself, since the light could have been traveling for 5 billion years, but the Earth only got here yesterday to see it. I mean, that's philosophically possible. But since Genesis indicates that the sun, moon, and stars were created after the Earth was already here, then if the stars are indeed 5 billion years old, then perhaps the Earth is too. It must be, if Genesis has any validity. And we're talking now about Christians who are old Earth creationists. They say, well, we'd have to say if the stars were made after the Earth and the stars are 5 billion years old at least, then the Earth must be at least that old. And that's one line of evidence. Another line of evidence comes from the rate of decay of radioactive materials. Certain radioactive isotopes of uranium and thorium and potassium actually decay at a measurable rate into other simpler substances. Uranium and thorium decay into lead, and potassium decays into a substance called argon. The rate of decay is measurable. That is the speed that the decay takes place. And it has been measured that uranium decays into lead at a speed that is described like this. They say the half-life of uranium is 4.5 billion years. What that really means is that if you have a solid uranium stone and if you keep it around for 4.5 billion years, it will decay halfway to lead. So that if you happen to find a stone that is half uranium and half lead, the assumption is that it must have been around for 4.5 billion years in order to decay that far. And it is the decay of radioactive minerals and the rate of decay that gives some of the strongest evidence for a very old Earth. Because they say, well, look, we can see how much this has decayed, and we know how fast it decays, therefore we know how long it must have been in the process of decay in order to get to the stage it's at now. Now, these are the principal arguments. Anytime you hear someone saying, science has proven that the Earth is billions of years old, I dare say these are the two arguments you'll hear. But not much else besides just evolutionary assumptions. The assumption that it must have taken millions or billions of years for evolution to take place. And the assumption that evolution is true is another age, argument for the age of the Earth. The argument for the age of the Earth really comes from evolutionary philosophy more than anything else. But to find some objective data in science to try to prove the Earth's age requires that we go to starlight and the decay of radioactive minerals. These are the two strong evidences for an old Earth. And let me just say this. As I said, I don't have anything emotionally at stake here. If the Earth is in fact billions of years old, it doesn't change anything about the fact that God created it and my obligation to serve Him and so forth is all intact. I don't lose much. I don't surrender much if I would say, yes, creation took place billions of years ago. But I'm not convinced. One reason is that the two evidences given are very nebulous. For example, the starlight example. It is true that if a star is 5 billion light years away, and if it began to send light our direction 5 billion years ago, it would just be arriving right now. But if God created the stars, as the Bible says He did, to give light on the earth, it is hard to imagine why He would do so without creating it with the light already reaching the earth. Why would God make stars to give light on the earth? Specifically stated as such, His reason for doing so is to give light on the earth. Why would He do that and yet wait 5 billion years for the light to get there? If God can create the star and the earth, can't He create the beam of light already spanning the distance, if that is what He made it for? Now, some people think that's a ridiculous suggestion, but I don't see why it would be a ridiculous suggestion. I mean, is it ridiculous to suggest that God made things? Then why would it be ridiculous to say He made them the way He wanted them? If God made stars, and He made earth, and He made the stars to give light on the earth, would He not have the capacity to make starlight already giving light on the earth at the time that it first appeared? I can think of no arguments against this, except those of bigotry against the supernatural in general. Now, what I've suggested this to some people, and they say, well, then what? God deceived us. God, you know, God only made it look like it took 5 billion years for the light to get here. So why do you do it that way? If you would look at Adam and Eve the day they were created, they were no older than a one-day-old baby. But did they look like babies? If a doctor could be transported in a time machine back there to the second day of Adam and Eve's life, and he didn't know the biblical story, he was just told to examine these people, how old would he think they were? Well, he certainly wouldn't conclude they were 1 or 2 days old, because, first of all, they had adult muscular development. They were walking. Babies don't do that. They had adult-sized bodies. And that means the number of cells in their bodies must have been more comparable to the number of cells in an adult body than in a baby's body. They had teeth, including they probably had their permanent teeth, in all likelihood. Their hair was grown. Men undoubtedly had facial hair. They were no doubt sexually mature individuals because they were made to immediately begin to fill the earth and to multiply. In other words, everything scientific about these people would give the impression that they had had a history, that they had lived a long time, that they had reached maturity, because our frame of reference is that we have only known people who reach such a condition after going through babyhood and childhood and so forth, and it takes time. But since God made Adam and Eve to be sexually functional immediately, in a world where they had no parents to nurture them as little babies, He made them as adults. Now, He didn't do that to deceive anybody. He just did that because He needed functional adults, and He needed them right now. He could have made functional stars whose light already reached the world if that's what He wanted there. I mean, we now can somewhat measure the rate of production of soil by erosion. We know that sand and dirt are caused by erosion, glacial movement against the surface of a mountain, for instance, or whatever, will create a certain amount of, you know, dirt and what we call dirt and granular soil. And we could say, well, you know, the amount of soil on the world must have taken billions of years to create in that way. And yet, on the third day, God made dry land and planted plants in it the same day. Obviously, there must have been soil present right away. Now, if you, again, would take a geologist back to the earth even before man appeared and look at the first plants and the soil they were in, he could look at the soil and say, well, this soil, you know, this must have taken millions of years to grind this small, because that's the rate that it's ground small now. But God made it already. He needed soil ready-made to plant plants in. Now, He may have said in progress, the processes that continue to make more soil at a slow rate, but there's no reason to believe that He didn't make things functional immediately. And functional means they had to bear the appearance of maturity. The people, the animals, the soil, the starlight. It was all made for a purpose, and therefore had to be made, if things were made suddenly, they were made suddenly functional. And that deprives of validity any argument that the light reaching the earth from the stars must mean it took billions of years. To my mind, a person who is not biased against the notion of creation can as easily suggest that God created the sun and the moon and the stars, as the Bible says, but when they did appear, their light appeared intact immediately on earth because that's what it was made for. Likewise, as far as the decay of radioactive elements, it is true that uranium decays at a rate of 4.5 billion years per half life. And therefore, it would seem logical that if you find a stone half uranium, half lead, you'd say that stone took 4.5 billion years to get to that condition. But that requires at least a couple of assumptions to be made. First of all, it assumes that we know the original content of that stone. If today it is 50% uranium and 50% lead, do we know for sure it was ever 100% uranium? We weren't there when it came into existence. We have only found it in this condition. What if it was already close to 50% lead and 50% uranium at the time it came into existence? Then we would know nothing about how long it took to get to its present state. In other words, one assumption that has to be made to make this line of reasoning valid is to assume we know something about the original percentage of the parent element and the daughter elements, uranium being the parent element and lead the daughter element. What if the percentage was not too different than it is now when the thing came into existence? What is there that would compel God to make uranium stones pure uranium to start with? I can't think of any reason why we would be forced to that assumption. Another assumption it makes is that we know for sure that the rate of decay has always been constant. In other words, if it takes 4.5 billion years today at the present rate of decay to reach that result, what if the rate of decay was not constant and that at earlier times in Earth's history, the rate of decay was, let's say, faster? Then the same result would have been reached in a shorter time. Now, no one knows for sure, and certainly no one can prove whether the rate of decay has been constant or whether at some time in the past it was faster than it is now. And no one can prove whether the original elements were 100% in their parent element form and have only decayed into their present state. We don't know those things. It is possible. It is true that given the assumptions of the geologists, the assumption is this stone is originally 100% uranium and the rate of decay has always been the same as it is now, given those assumptions, you could conclude this rock is 4.5 billion years old. But those assumptions are nothing better than assumptions. No one can either prove nor disprove that the rate of decay has been constant or what the original state of that stone was. So we're left without solid knowledge to really make a decision on it. I'm not trying to debunk it out of hand and say that the reasoning behind it is totally fallacious. I'm just saying that it depends on certain assumptions that cannot be demonstrated and may not be true. Therefore, we don't have solid proof in this form of a very old Earth. Now, there are similar kinds of evidence with the subject to the same limitations that would point to a young Earth. For example, every planet has a magnetic field. Actually, all solid objects have magnetic field. The Earth's magnetic field is of a measurable strength. The scientists have the apparatus to measure the strength of the Earth's magnetic field. They also know that it's decaying. That is, the strength of the field is becoming weaker through time. And if one would suggest, again, this is an assumption, no one knows for sure, but if the rate of decay of the Earth's magnetic field remained constant and never changed, then you could, of course, take the strength of the field now and work backward how strong it must have been back, you know, 1,000, 2,000, 10,000 years ago from the same rate of present decay. And it is said that if the rate of the Earth's magnetic field's decay were constant from the beginning until now, then 20,000 years ago, the Earth's magnetic field would have been as great as that of a magnetic star, which is incredibly unlikely. I mean, that a small planet like this would ever have such a tremendous magnetic field is simply not considered to be scientifically likely. That would suggest, again, if the rate of decay has been constant, which no one knows for sure, that the Earth probably hasn't been around as much as 20,000 years. Also, there is a certain density of uranium salts in the oceans of the world. Scientists can measure the density of salts in the ocean. They can also measure the rate of accumulation, because these salts come from rivers and streams that empty into the ocean, and they carry it out of the ground that the streams, erosion of the riverbed and so forth, carries these elements into the ocean. Scientists now can estimate the approximate rate of accumulation of new salts in the ocean. And it has been pointed out that at the present rate of increase of saline content in the ocean would have reached its present saline solution in 1 million years if there was no salt in it to begin with. That is to say, if God made the oceans pure, without salt, they would have reached their present saline level within 1 million years. Now, that's a lot shorter than 4.5 billion years. Now, the Bible would certainly call into question whether the oceans have been here even 1 million years. But you see, if there was already salt in the ocean when they came into existence, then the present rate would have been reached, who knows? I mean, depending on how much salt was already there. One thing we can say is that even if the oceans were pure at their birth, they would have reached their present levels in 1 million years, not billions of years. And if there was a fair density of salt in the ocean when it came into existence, then we'd have no way of saying, but it would certainly curtail the number back, you know, to a very much smaller number of years. Again, pointing possibly in the direction of a younger Earth. There are other considerations of similar sort. You may have heard of the accumulation of cosmic dust both on the moon and on the Earth. Once again, there is an accumulation of dust from space, from meteorites and stuff that crash into each other. There's just dust floating around out there, and some of it enters into the gravitational field of the Earth and of the Moon and begins to accumulate on the surface. And scientists have been able to measure for some time the rate of accumulation of cosmic dust on the planet Earth. It has been said that if the Earth was 4.5 billion years old, and this rate of accumulation has been more or less constant, then there would be literal mountains of cosmic dust all over the Earth. However, such dust cannot be found, neither on Earth nor on the ocean bottoms. There just isn't that much cosmic dust on the Earth, suggesting that either the rate of accumulation was not the same in the past, or else the Earth hasn't been here collecting it as long as they would like us to believe. You may have heard the story about how the lunar landing craft, before anyone had landed on the moon before, the first craft to land on the moon had these big pads instead of feet, you know, to land on the moon. And the reason was because the scientists assumed that the moon was 4 billion years old. And they assumed that this powdery cosmic dust would be piled up perhaps, you know, yards deep, maybe hundreds of yards deep. I mean, they just thought there'd be all kinds of dust and that this craft would just sink right down into it and be submerged in it unless it had these big pads for feet. But when they landed on the moon, they found there was a fraction of an inch of the stuff there. And again, suggesting the probability that the moon hasn't been collecting dust from space for the billions of years that they've suggested. Now, I'm not saying that any of these things prove a young Earth, because the rate of accumulation, again, is an assumption. We don't know if it's always been constant. These don't prove a young Earth any more than the other arguments prove an older. But if the old arguments' assumptions can be taken as valid, then the young Earth arguments can be valid for the same reasons. And there's actually more for a young Earth. There's more of these kinds of considerations that point to a younger Earth. So I'm not arguing that we can prove from any of these things the age of the Earth. I'm saying that those who say we can are whistling in the wind. They're really claiming more evidence than exists for their propositions. Now, because many Christians have felt the Earth is billions of years old and they've gone along with the old Earth assumptions, some have felt that we need to modify the way we look at the first two verses of Genesis. I already mentioned the so-called day-age theory, that each day was an age, but there's been many Christians who've seen weakness in that suggestion, and they say there's a better way to account for the age of the Earth being very ancient, even if we allow the 6 days to be 24-hour days. After all, it says in verse 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. It doesn't say when. Next we read in verse 2, the earth was without form and void. Now, the word was in verse 2, the earth was without form and void, is a Hebrew word that appears over 4,000 times in the Old Testament. Sometimes it can mean became as opposed to was. There are times when this word should be translated became. And some folks say, well, that's what we should translate it as here. Instead of saying the earth was without form and void, what if we translated the earth became formless and void? In other words, this formless and void condition was not the original condition of the earth when it was made, but it happened later. It became this way. That would suggest that there was some passage of time from the time God created the heavens and the earth to the time that it became formless and void. And something happened in between the creation of it and the state of it that we read of in verse 2. This is what we call the gap theory. And on this theory, there is a gap of unknown duration between verse 1 and verse 2 of this chapter. In verse 1, God created the heavens and the earth. Then a whole bunch of stuff happened, possibly for billions of years. And then the earth became formless and void, and God started over and created land and plants and animals again in 6 days after that. On this view, Genesis 1, verses 2 to the end of the chapter literally do occur within 6 chronological days. But verse 1 is detached from all that activity by a gap of unknown duration, which could be billions of years. People have gotten real creative with this theory. Some have said maybe that's when the dinosaurs were here, during this gap time. Or maybe that's when evolution occurred. Maybe evolution actually occurred during this gap time. Some say even Lucifer may have ruled the world during that time, and his fall may have been the thing that caused the earth to become formless and void. That in verse 2, we're actually reading of a judgment condition on the earth, because there's actually a theory out there that there was a whole race of humans before Adam, living during this gap, that either evolved or were created and were ruled over by Lucifer. And then when Lucifer fell, this whole pre-Adamic, before Adam, human race was corrupted and was judged. And God overflowed the world with water like he did in the days of Noah. And he wiped out that whole race and started over again. And so all this speculation about this pre-Adamic human race, you know, the presence of the dinosaurs, the maybe even Lucifer living on earth and falling there, all that is guessed at between verse 1 and 2 of Genesis in this alleged gap. And on what basis do we get this gap? Only on the allegation that the word was in verse 2 should be translated became. The earth became formless and void. However, the first thing we need to ask in assessing this theory is, does the word was require that we retranslate it to became? Well, there'd be two ways of perhaps answering that question. One would be etymological. What is the etymological meaning of the word? Is it was or is it became? The other would be a theological question. Is there anything in theology that compels us to understand it that way? First of all, as far as the etymology is concerned, I might just put it in a statistical way. I don't have the exact numbers, but I've read them. The word that is here translated was, in verse 2, appears over 4,000 times in the Old Testament. In, I believe it's a handful of times, no more than 10, it's translated became. All the rest of the time it simply means was. It's just a simple past tense of the word to be. Therefore, statistically and usage-wise, it's very rare for this word to be translated became. There may be instances where the context demands it. Is this one of them? If this isn't, that is to say, if this context here does not demand that we change it to became, then there's no statistical or etymological or lexical reason that we would be compelled to change it. Was is a perfectly good translation in the vast overwhelming majority of cases where this word appears. Therefore, there's no compelling reason to change it here to the word became. But there is another consideration, and that is the theological consideration. It is argued by those who hold this gap theory that the Bible teaches us elsewhere that when God made the earth, He didn't make it formless and void. Therefore, when verse 2 says the earth was formless and void, it must have become that way because God didn't make it that way originally. Now, where do they get that idea? Essentially, there's two scriptures that are used to prove that God did not originally make the earth formless and void. One of them is Isaiah 45 and verse 18. In Isaiah 45 and verse 18, God says, "For thus says the Lord, who created the heavens, who is God, who formed the earth and made it, who established it, who did not create it in vain, who formed it to be inhabited." Okay? Now, the word "in vain" there in the second to the last line of verse 18 is the same Hebrew word that is translated "void" in Genesis 1:2. The earth was formless and void. Same Hebrew word that's here translated "in vain." So if you translated it consistently in both places, let's say you translated it "void" in both places, then you have here a statement, God did not create the earth void. He made it to be inhabited. And therefore, it would mean that when the earth was void, it was not the original condition. God didn't originally make it void. It became void. And that argues for the translation, the earth became formless and void in Genesis 1:2. Now, there's a problem with pressing this point to make that point. And one is that the term that is here translated "in vain" can, of course, be translated "void," but it can also be translated "in vain." And "in vain" means for no purpose. And when he says, "I did not make it in vain, I formed it to be inhabited," it makes perfectly good sense without rendering it void. God didn't make it for no purpose. He made it to be inhabited. He's not telling us the condition of the world when he made it. He's telling us the purpose for making it. One thing else I would point out is that elsewhere in the chapter, I think the very next verse, notice this. He says, "I have not spoken in secret." This is verse 19, Isaiah 45:19. "In a dark place of the earth, I did not say to the seed of Jacob, 'Seek me in vain.'" Same word, "in vain." Now translate that "void" if you can. "I did not say to Jacob, 'Seek me void.'" No, obviously, "in vain" is the meaning there in verse 19. And since the same word is found in the previous verse, it probably means the same thing in both places. I didn't make the earth in vain, and I didn't tell Jacob to seek me in vain. There seems to be a symmetry intended between those two verses. And since in verse 19 it would make no sense to translate it "void," it's very unlikely that it should be translated "void" in verse 18. In other words, these verses have no bearing on Genesis chapter 1 and the translation of Genesis 1:2. There is another verse, though, that is thought to be useful for proving their point. That's Jeremiah chapter 4. In Jeremiah chapter 4, in verses 23 through 27, Jeremiah gives us a description of something here. Verses 23 through 27, "I beheld the earth, and indeed it was without form and void." That expression, "without form and void," is exactly identical in the Hebrew to the expression "without form and void" in Genesis 1:2. Read on. "And the heavens, they had no light." That sounds also like Genesis 1:2. "Darkness was upon the face of the deep." Go on. "I beheld the mountains, and indeed they trembled, and the hills moved back and forth. I beheld, and indeed there was no man. And all the birds of the heavens had fled. I beheld, and indeed the fruitful land was a wilderness, and all the cities were broken down at the presence of the Lord by His fierce anger." Now here's how these verses are thought to teach something about Genesis 1. Notice he says, "I beheld the earth, it was formless and void, and the heavens had no light." That sounds like he's describing the condition of Genesis 1:2. But he goes on to say things about cities that had been broken down and fruitful cultivated lands that had now become a wilderness, and the birds had fled and the mountains trembled and so forth. Now, does this mean that before the events of Genesis 1:2, when the earth was formed, that there had previously been cities that were now broken down, birds that had now fled, tilled fields that are gone back to seed? That is what is suggested by those who use it this way. They say, you see, before Genesis 1-2, there were civilizations. There were farms. There were birds. There were all those things that weren't there in Genesis 1-2. They had been destroyed now. And therefore, they belong to a gap which falls between the creation of the heavens and the earth and the formlessness and voidness of Genesis 1-2. Now, the problem with this interpretation is that it just doesn't work. For one thing, it doesn't work. When the earth is without form and void, in Genesis 2, there are no mountains to tremble. There are no wildernesses that were once fields. There's only water. Jeremiah describes a situation where the wilderness is there. The mountains are there. The birds aren't there anymore, but there, where there were fields, there's now wilderness. Genesis 1-2 doesn't describe a situation where there's wildernesses and where there's mountains. The mountains didn't appear till the third day, and the wilderness, likewise, must have come after that. So we can't have a direct correlation of this to Genesis chapter 1 and verse 2. Furthermore, Jeremiah doesn't intend it to be understood that way. In the context, Jeremiah is describing the judgment that is coming on Jerusalem from the Babylonians, how the people will be deported to Babylon, and the land of Israel will be devastated and laid bare and left without its former inhabitants. He, in order to poetically describe how thorough this destruction of Jerusalem is, he described it in his vision. He says, I saw it. It's like the land. The word earth can be translated land. It's eretz in the Hebrew. It's the same word for land. The land was formless and void. It's clear he doesn't mean the earth because it's got mountains. It's got wilderness. He's talking about the land of Israel. The land of Israel is formless and void. Yes, he uses language from Genesis 1-2, and deliberately. He's trying to point out that because of the judgment of God on Jerusalem, the land of Israel has become empty and fruitless, comparable, although by way of hyperbole and exaggeration, to the way the earth was before God put anything there in the first place. Now, he makes it clear he's not making an exact parallel because he's got mountains, he's got wilderness, he's got some things there, broken down cities and so forth. But he is not describing Genesis 1. He is taking language that is found in Genesis 1 and applying it to a condition that would prevail after God judged Jerusalem. And basically saying this formlessness and voidness and vacancy of the world, such as you read of in Genesis, is a good metaphor for the way God's going to leave Israel when the Babylonians have come through. We only read the relevant verses in Jeremiah 4. If you read the whole chapter, you'd find that the prediction there is of the Babylonian invasion and the destruction of Jerusalem and Judah. So the context tells us that he's not trying to tell us anything about Genesis 1, verse 2. He's only borrowing imagery from that verse to talk about an entirely different situation. So are we left without any way of knowing whether there's a gap between Genesis 1-1 and 1-2? Well, I think we can know. If you look at Exodus chapter 20, we'll find that God actually answers the question for us. In Exodus chapter 20, where God is giving for the first time the Ten Commandments, and when he is talking about the commandment to keep the Sabbath holy, he makes this point. Exodus 20, verse 11. God says, "For in 6 days the Lord, Jehovah, made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day." Now, if you were paying attention, you might have noticed something significant to our present inquiry. In 6 days, the Lord made what? The heavens and the earth and the sea and everything in them. The heavens, the earth, and everything in them were made in what span of time? 6 days. Now, the gap theory says God made the heavens and the earth at one time, and maybe millions of years later made the things that were in them. But God says that within the space of 6 days total, he made the heavens and the earth and all that's in them. It does not leave room for a gap of millions of years between the creation of the heavens and the earth on the one hand and the creation of the things that fill them now on the other. It seems clear that God was not promoting the modern gap theory. And by the way, the gap theory arose not because of biblical scholarship, but because of embarrassment on the part of Christians, because it was thought, because scientists claimed, that they had proven that the earth is much too old for Genesis to be true. And therefore, since Genesis would certainly imply an age of the earth measured in thousands, not millions or billions of years, they thought, well, we can find those billions somewhere in Genesis. We'll stick it between verse 1 and verse 2. It was simply a theory of accommodation to a now discredited scientific theory of the age of the earth. It's not thoroughly discredited, but it is certainly held in question by many scientists now. And there's certainly no reason to jury-rig the book of Genesis to try to fit what scientists are now abandoning in fairly large numbers. Okay, now down to the somewhat details. I just want to make some observations about the whole creation week. We've talked about what was made when and talked about some of this stuff. Initially, when God made the earth, it was covered with water and there was no light. And so the first order of business was to create light. Now, when he said, let there be light, this was not the light of the sun, moon, and stars, because we read those came along on the fourth day. Some people said Genesis doesn't even make sense because we got the plants on the third day, and plants need light to survive, but the sun, moon, and stars weren't even made till the next day. Furthermore, we have morning and evening and the passage of day and night before the moon, sun, and stars. They say this can't be literal. Why not? Certainly the author of Genesis, even if he were not inspired, would know that in our present solar system, we need the sun to measure days and nights. This is not a discovery of modern science. They have known forever that the sun is the present measure of day and night. The author also is aware that he does not mention the creation of the sun until the fourth day. But he has not left us without a sensible way of measuring day and night. There is light. It's just not coming from the sun yet. Where is it coming from? Apparently from God himself. You know, in the new earth, in the new Jerusalem, we read in Revelation that the city has no need of the sun or the moon or the stars to shine in it. Because what? The glory of God lightens it. The new Jerusalem is illuminated not by the sun, moon, and stars, but by the glory of God. Is it impossible that the earth before the creation of the sun, moon, and stars might have been illuminated by the same light? It seems not impossible, not even improbable. In fact, Paul refers to this and makes a spiritual application of it in 2 Corinthians 4:6. Paul says, God, who called the light to shine out of darkness, referring to this, where he said, let there be light, in Genesis 1, he says, God, who called the light to shine out of darkness, has shined in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. Paul likens the light that God created on the first day, or allowed to be there on the first day, to the glory of God illuminating our hearts. It's a supernatural light. Later on, he made the sun, moon, and stars to become the natural light bearers. But initially, he lit the creation by his own light. Now, this raises a logical question. If God intended to make the sun, moon, and stars eventually to give light on the earth, why not just do that right at the beginning? He needed light right at the beginning. He wanted there to be day and night. He wanted light first thing. Why not just do what he did later? Why not just make the sun, moon, and stars in the first place? And I can't give you an answer that would be authoritative. I can give you a very reasonable answer, it seems to me. And that is this. That pagan societies have always worshipped the sun. Even in societies which had many gods, generally speaking, the sun god was considered to be the chief god. Because the sun is known in agricultural and agrarian societies to be absolutely necessary for life. It sustains life. The sunlight causes the plants to grow. The plants provide food for all living creatures. And the sun is therefore the source of all life. Actually, naturally speaking, that is true. But that doesn't mean we should worship the sun as our source of life. Most pagan cultures have done so. They've worshipped the sun, and they see it as the source of life. But God deliberately made the sun later to prove that life could exist here before the sun. The sun is not our source. God was able to provide light and vegetation and life before the sun. The original light came from God himself. Thus showing God as the true source of life, not the sun, as pagans forever afterwards have always thought. And that might be why God deliberately waited and made the sun later on, so that it wouldn't be mistaken as the source of everything else. God's light initially was there, and one thing he did was divide the light from the darkness. Now, it's interesting that there are, in the first 3 days, God makes things and divides things that already are there. When God made light, apparently he only made it on one side of the earth at a time, and it was dark on the other side, so that there was a rotation, as now, which caused a succession of day and night, light and darkness. And he gave names to that. He divided between the light and the darkness. You can't have light and darkness together. In fact, it says of spiritual light and spiritual darkness in 1 John chapter 1, verse 7, or verse 6, that God is light and in him is no darkness at all. If we say that we have fellowship with him and walk in darkness, we lie and do not the truth. But if we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship one with another, and the blood of Jesus Christ, his Son, cleanses us from all sin. Notice that light and darkness don't mix. In God, there's no darkness at all. In nature, God has so made it that the light and darkness are in two different places. They don't mix. This is to be a spiritual image, no doubt. God did it this way to illustrate spiritual light and spiritual darkness. But we see him making a division initially between light and darkness. The next day, he made a division between waters above the firmament and waters below. Apparently, all the waters previous to the second day were on the earth as oceans. And there were no continents, so everything was ocean. But God distilled some of that water to be up above the atmosphere. Now, there's two theories as to what he actually did here. There's one view that he just distilled water into clouds as we now see them. There is even today water above the atmosphere and water below it. The water below is, the vast majority of it is salt water in the oceans. The water above is distilled, pure water, that is in the clouds. It rains down pure water into the rivers and into the lakes and so forth so that they have fresh water. These eventually, though, run down into the ocean and it evaporates again. And it's basically the waters above the firmament that are pure and drinkable and life-sustaining. And so it is thought that perhaps by dividing waters below and above, he was actually taking two different kinds of water. The salt water, which does not sustain animal life as a drinking fluid, and the waters above the firmament, which were purified waters, later accessible to the plants and animals for sustaining life. Another view of this is that God did not initially make clouds or rain at all in the first place. There are some who believe that the clouds and rain were a phenomenon that began after the flood, and that for the first 1,500 years or so of creation, there was no rain. We do read in chapter 2 that there was at least one very early period before God made it rain, where a mist came up and watered the ground and kept the plants alive. How long this condition prevailed, we don't know. But at least very early on, there was a time without rain. Whether this continued till the time of the flood is never stated. But it is thought that the waters above the firmament that God created were not in the form of clouds as we have it now, but rather as a water vapor canopy at the outer edge of the atmosphere surrounding the earth. Now, this canopy does not exist today, but it is thought that perhaps it once did. And if so, that would have effects on the climate and on the longevity of living creatures, because a vapor canopy of water around the Earth's atmosphere would tend to distribute the heat of the sun more evenly around the Earth, resulting in a largely tropical Earth without polar ice caps and so forth. It's interesting that in many of the parts of the Earth that are currently under permafrost and never thaw, there are coal deposits. Coal deposits are thought to be caused by large amounts of vegetation dying. Coal is believed to be simply vegetation that has fossilized. Likewise, oil, petroleum, is thought to be animal life that's fossilized. That's why we call it fossil fuels. Coal and oil are fossil fuels, because coal comes from plants and oil comes from animals that have died. At least that is what is believed to be the case. And yet under the polar ice caps today in the Arctic and the Antarctic, there are coal deposits, enormous ones, which suggest there was once lots of plant life there. that later became cold. Today, it never thaws. It's frozen. There's nothing but snow and ice there now all the time. There's no plant life can grow there now. It suggests that there was a time in Earth's history where those frozen regions were much more conducive for plant life. Another interesting discovery that's been well publicized is that many, many mammoths have been found in the Aleutian Islands and in Siberia. These are creatures that are sort of old-fashioned type of elephants, larger than modern elephants and hairier, and have larger tusks, but in general they are elephant-shaped creatures. But they have found complete frozen mammoths, not bones in rock, but actual encased in ice mammoths with their hair and their skin and everything intact, their eyeballs and everything. I mean, they're supposedly millions or billions of years old, probably just millions, evolutionists would say, but they've been frozen for all these years, and they've never decayed. In fact, they found that when they thawed some of them out, the meat wasn't even rotten. The sled dogs were able to eat it without ill effect. And yet they're supposedly hundreds of thousands of years old. What's really interesting, though, is they were found in frozen regions of the earth that never thaw. That's why they've been able to stay there unrotted. But when they were dissected, they found that in their stomachs and even in their mouths, there were flowers and other tropical vegetation in their mouths. They hadn't even swallowed yet, and they were encased in ice so suddenly, freeze-dried, that the food in their mouth didn't even have a chance to be swallowed or to decompose. And today, thousands of years later, you can find the food in their bellies and their mouths still there. But the interesting thing is what they were eating when they froze was tropical vegetation. And yet the spot where they were eating it is now under ice. Now, these are mysterious realities that are, you know, objectively provable. Anyone can do the research and find that these are true. But the explanation is what's not so obvious. But it would appear possible that the whole earth was at one time tropical. Possibly until the time of the flood. At the time of the flood, it is thought possible that the earth may have shifted on its axis, creating the poles and their extra distance from the sun that wouldn't have been the case before the shift. You know, the earth is not perpendicular on its axis. It's tilted. And no one knows exactly why, but it is that tilt that actually causes the seasons and causes certain parts of the earth to be far enough from the sun all the time to be frozen all the time. Now, it's possible that prior to the flood, there was this canopy around the atmosphere that distributed the heat of the sun evenly around the earth so that it was like what some people have called a greenhouse effect, although today we use that expression for a negative effect of the global warming, but more of a positive greenhouse effect, that the whole earth was like a tropical paradise until the time of the flood. This would have been caused possibly by this vapor canopy around the atmosphere. Another effect would be that it would shield the earth from a tremendous amount of cosmic radiation from the sun and other sources in space that currently bombard us every moment of every day. The radiation comes right through the ceiling. It's, you know, we are right through our bodies. There's radiation of various kinds coming from out there, you know, and it contributes to our aging. I mean, our bodies reproduce every cell every 7 years, and yet we don't have all new cells and all new bodies every 7 years. We get older bodies. Our bodies get older. They get more brittle. The skin gets more wrinkled. Why? If we get all new cells every 7 years, why aren't we like a new 7-year-old child every 7 years? Why would we ever age? Well, partly because of environmental conditions, including food and nutritional considerations, but also because of this radiation that comes on our planet continuously. It causes a deterioration in the quality of cells so that aging happens. It is said that if there was a canopy of water vapor around the earth originally, around the atmosphere, this would have shielded the earth from a tremendous amount of this radiation. Not all of it, but much of it. And it would possibly account for the longer lives lived, hundreds of years long, before the flood. But after the flood, people's lifespan went down pretty quickly down to what it is more like today. And it is thought perhaps at the flood the water canopy was dumped. It was condensed on the earth, and that created one of the things that created the flood. But after that we see a rainbow for the first time. Now rainbows are caused simply by the natural interplay of light upon water vapor in our present system of
precipitation, of evaporation and precipitation. And it is thought that if there was no rainbow before the flood, it must have been because there were no clouds and rain before the flood. So these are some of the things that contribute to the theory. No one knows for sure. But when God put waters above the firmament, it's possible that he created an actual shield of water vapor to protect the earth from much of the damaging radiation that comes from space and that increases the aging process, and also to help distribute the heat around the earth more evenly and the moisture, so that the earth was much more paradisical, you know, in those days. But at the time of the flood, this vapor canopy was removed. It was replaced with a system of evaporation and precipitation. It explained the appearance of the rainbow. It explains a number of things. It's only a theory, and it may not be true, but it is a theory that would account for a number of things in the creation story and in the Bible in general. Well, we then read of God separating the waters from the waters horizontally. The waters above and below the firmament was a vertical division, but then when he made land, he separated waters from each other horizontally with land in between them. And he called the waters seas, and the dry ground he called earth, and so forth. Then he made the sun, moon, and stars in the heavens. Now, some people believe that God didn't make them at this point, but he just caused them to appear, that they were already around for billions of years before this, but in the early days of the earth, there was just a haziness in the sky that made them invisible to the earth, and that God cleared up the haze now so their light would reach the earth at this point. I don't see any reason to argue that. It doesn't seem to be stated or implied, but if someone wanted to believe that, that's their business. All we can say is that God at this point delegated the job of lighting the earth to these planets, lights, they're not planets, but lights in the heavens. And since that time, it has not been the glory of the Lord, but these natural light-bearing bodies that have illuminated the earth. I don't know that I need to explain much about the creation of land and sea animals and flying animals. We've already had brief comments about that. When it comes to the creation of man and woman, which is the crowning act of the creation, we get more detail on this in chapter 2. And we're going to stop here because we're out of time. And when we come back to our next Genesis class, we will go into chapter 2, but we'll also deal with chapter 1, verses 26 through 31, which talk about the creation of man and woman. And it's simply looked at under a microscope in chapter 2 and given much more detail. This being the most important act of creation, it'll be the one we'll give separate attention to, as does the Bible itself later on. So we'll stop there and move along into the creation of humans next time we come together and look at Genesis.